The Holy Gospel according to St. Luke, the 6th chapter.
Glory to you, Lord.
Then Jesus looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, and when they exclude you, revile you, and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for truly your reward is great in heaven. For that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets. But I say to you that listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you." The Gospel of the Lord. Each year, as the church moves into this time when we lift up the saints, I take time to reflect upon those people in my own life who have taught me about God, who have taught me about life, and even have taught me about myself. I think of my grandmother, who was known for saying that there is more love in the tip of God's pinky than the world can handle. I think of my grandfather, who built the log cabin that we still as a family own in Huntington County, the logs cut by hand before the day of chainsaws, the basement dug with his mule and his scoop, a house that still stands strong and is a great place for us to gather as a family. I think of my mother, who had dreams that I would have some type of talent as a musician, whose goal was to teach me to be a musician, but even more so, the goal that I would become better at music than her. I think about my father, who had his assigned chair in the family room at home, and none of us as children would dare sit in his chair because that belonged to him. Even as an adult, when I visit my parents and I'm sitting in his recliner and he walks in the room, I immediately get up and move and give him his chair. But my father, who when he is visiting in my house, will not sit in my chair out of respect for me. I think about two elderly ladies who, after I preached a sermon at a nursing home a couple of years ago, came up to greet me after the service, and the first one grabbed my hand and heartily shook my hand and said, "Great sermon, Pastor." Her friend came up afterwards, shook my hand, and then pointed to her friend and said, "Don't listen to her, she's deaf." Learned a little bit about myself that day. As you live as a disciple of Jesus in this world, what are you doing to shape the lives of those around you? Jesus embodied the will of God. And as he embodied the will of God and was present on this earth, Jesus encountered the reality that humanity will reject the will of God. So as Jesus walked the earth, as he taught, as he spent time with those who were outcasts, as he challenged the way people went about life, he offended the human beings around him. And as a result, humanity's desire was to bring Jesus to death. You could have seen it coming earlier. At first, it started with the kind of looks that they would give Jesus when he was doing his ministry. You have either given those looks or have received those looks yourself. When someone looks at you and the look in that person's eye says, "I think you're a complete idiot." They had chosen to use words that were cutting of Jesus and behind his back would speak ill of him to destroy his reputation. They moved to actually finding ways to trap Jesus in public so he would teach in a way that was offensive, and then they could then counter him and discredit him among people. They moved to the point where they came up with a plan to actually have him arrested and have him killed. So determined were they to reject the will of God. And Jesus died on the cross. Now in Luke, Jesus' death on the cross is the same as your death and my death. It's when the breathing stops, when the heart stops beating, the blood no longer courses through the veins, and there's nothing left. It would appear at that moment that the rejection of God's will was final and was ultimate, but what we discover is that God vindicated Jesus for those who brought his destruction. And what we will see is that any time that people have come at each other in ways that diminish one another, that destroy one another, that violate one another with words and actions and looks, that God vindicates those people. And even the very fact that Jesus was raised from the dead, that vindication is bodily vindication. That every person has an integrity that is not to be violated by anyone. Each person has an integrity that is not to be violated by anyone. Now, we in our nation have put into place laws that hold people accountable who do violate the integrity of others. And so if there are certain ways that one person speaks to discredit another, there are laws in place to handle and deal with those who violate one another in that way. If someone violates another person by stealing something that belongs to that person, there are laws in place that allow us to deal with people who violate by stealing. We have laws in place that say if one person violates another person by causing physical harm, there are ways that we deal with that. And even to the point that if one person violates the very body and life of another, there are ways that we deal with that as well. We allow ourselves as a nation to respond to that violation of integrity by taking and violating the integrity of the other person. So you break a law, we take away your freedom, and you go to prison as a consequence of what you have done wrong. And even in some places in this country, we will violate the integrity of life itself by allowing room for the death penalty, because it's based on our understanding of justice. that if you do something wrong, there is an outcome, and you are then punished for what you do wrong. And we bring that simple sense of justice to our relationships with each other as well. That I will give the benefit of the doubt to people that I like. I will give the benefit of the doubt to people that pay attention to me. I will give the benefit of the doubt to those who tell me that I am good, that I want to spend time with, that I find attractive. But if I find the person repulsive, if I find the person objectionable, if I find that the person does something that is offensive to me, I will not treat that person with the same regard. The integrity that God gives a human being belongs to every person. It's an unjust grace because it's not something any person deserves. It's offensive to us because it tells us that God has high regard for people who do things that we find offensive. As we live this life as God's people, the way that we are with one another is a way that honors the integrity of each and every person. The teaching that comes out of this text is, if anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And I think that teaches us that to honor the integrity of another person means that we are in the presence of other people. I've had those moments when I have been in pastoral counseling with people, and we're getting so close to the truth, so close to that point when the person can see what's really going on, but it is too close to the truth, it is too painful, and the person stands up and walks out of my study because they don't want to be vulnerable and hear the pain of the truth. They don't want to be present in that moment of weakness. It's why we prefer to send the emails and the letters to people that make us angry. Don't you love those emails that say, there's no need to respond to this email? Now, it sounds like the person's being gracious, but what they're really saying is, I'm getting the last word, I'm throwing the grenade, it's going to blow up in your face, and you deal with the consequences. We want to be out of the presence of those things that make us uncomfortable, which is why we ignore those who are poor. Their very presence threatens us. Studies out of Princeton have shown, as people walk down the streets of cities, that they no longer even see those who are living in poverty sitting on the streets. We don't want to be in the presence of those who are mentally ill because it makes us very uncomfortable. It's unpredictable. We don't know what's going to happen next. It's what's leading business owners in downtown Lancaster to say the city needs to do something about those with mental illness, not out of a compassion for those who have mental illness, but because it's bad for business. So clear the streets of them so that we don't have to see them, because we don't want to be in the pain of those difficult moments that remind us of human weakness and human brokenness and human helplessness and our own vulnerability. As one homeless man rooting through the dumpster, finding food to eat, finally confronted the restaurant owner who refused to talk to him and said, "You're avoiding me because you realize you are only one step away from being me." It's about being present. about respect. Now, I think that we have lost the significance of the word respect, and at this point, we think that respect is simply, you know, paying due homage to someone who's more important than we are, which is what I do every day when Pastor Rooney walks into the building, as I get down on my hands and knees and I pay homage to him out of great respect. He still insists I don't do it enough for him, but I am working on that. But that's not what we're meaning when we talk about respect. Look at the original, the root of the word. Respect means to take a second look. And isn't that what it says in the text? If someone strikes you on the cheek, turn the other. Take a second look, because you might discover what's happening. Former seminarian and now pastor out in Wyoming, Pastor Tanya Iza, tells how a couple weeks ago she was walking her dog Otis down the sidewalk, and this lady came out and started yelling at her for walking her dog on that side of the street. And Pastor Iza was frustrated by this, but started walking her dog on the opposite side of the street, but posted on Facebook about how mean people can be, and she should have the right to walk her dog wherever she wants, and posted all of this on Facebook. Yesterday, Pastor Iza posted this. She was at a community gathering, and someone said, "Why aren't you walking your dog on our side of the street anymore?" She told them the story, and this person said, "Oh, I know who you mean. Do you realize that she's in the late stages of Alzheimer's? And one of the ways it's triggered is when she sees people walking on the street in front of her house." That second look opened up for her a new way of understanding a human being. And she had the integrity to apologize for what she had done wrong. We will not, as human beings, be able to avoid difficult situations. But the challenge becomes when we are in a bad situation, do we make it better or do we make it worse? What we do with our anger is one of those ways that we can make it better or worse. Anger is a normal feeling. It simply indicates that there is something is wrong or something has gone wrong. But what do you do with that anger when it's welling up inside of you? And I know those moments when someone has done something wrong and I've been mad and I've lashed out in that anger right away. What I have done is convince the other person that they were right and I was wrong. There's this strange human dynamic that comes into play that if you get angry with someone who's done something wrong, you will convince them that they were right and you were wrong. Test it out in your daily life. You'll find that to be the case. It's about challenging us to a way of living that is not always emotionally satisfying. There would be a lot of times when it would be a more emotionally satisfying to lay someone low, to put them in their place, to diminish the person. But doing what is right and honoring the integrity of others is usually not emotionally satisfying. And this is one of the challenges I think pastors face, but something that all Christians face. It is my challenge as a pastor never to speak to people in the same way they speak to me when they're angry. Never speak to another person the way that person speaks to me when they're hurt or when they're angry. It's not easy. It's not satisfying. But it's a glimpse of honoring the integrity of another person, that integrity which is a gift from God, and that integrity which says as we live in this world is a sign of the reign and the kingdom of God. And